Hey everyone, I'm Brooke.
And I'm Adria.
And this is What Have You Done? Every time.
We're back.
Oh, finally. It feels like it's been forever since we've recorded, because it kind of has.
I know. It has been.
But
it has been.
Life's crazy, and now that the weather is a little bit nicer, more activities are happening, so.
Right. Have we recorded since you went to Canada?
No.
Or no. Okay.
So.
I don't know if we knew last time. For recording that you were going to Canada.
I probably didn't know for sure, because I would have said something, but...
Right. It was last minute.
Yeah, a couple weekends ago, I went to Quebec to see Avril Lavigne, and it was such a fun weekend. I had such a good time. The concert was awesome. Everything about it was awesome. We drove, 6-7 hours there, and then 6-7 hours back the next day, but, you know, it was worth it.
Yeah, definitely worth it.
Didn't get stuck.
Especially if you're with someone that, you know, makes it fun. Like, it's not like you're just driving 6 hours by yourself, not talking to anybody.
Yeah, that definitely would have been rough, because the first 3 hours of the drive, I was by myself, so.
Oh, yeah.
It definitely, once I picked up my friend, it definitely was a lot better just having somebody there to talk to.
Yeah, definitely. Yep. Cool. So she puts on a pretty good show still.
Yeah, she does such a good job. She had Maud's son was with her too, and they sing their song together.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I don't really know him well or anything, but he was fun. He was all pumped up and jumping around. We had pretty good seats too. I got some really good videos.
Yeah, it looked like you were right. Like, you had such a good view of her from the videos that you showed.
Yeah, you could see her so well. Yeah, it was awesome. And then, you know, just got drunk and walked around Quebec and went to bed and then left in the morning. But it was fun.
That's awesome.
Did you go see that new movie yesterday?
Yeah, I saw Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness.
Whoa. How was it?
I know. It was good. It was good. I like Doctor Strange. He's one of my favorites from Marvel, but I don't know. It's hard because a lot of those movies, different directors do them. So this one was directed by Sam Raimi, and everyone has like a specific style.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked it. There's, like, you know, Marvel, everything's intertwined and you have to know stuff about.
Yeah.
Like, this one, if you didn't see WandaVision, then it probably doesn't. Some stuff, it makes sense. Like, you could still watch it, but I never finished it, so I didn't remember. Like, I didn't know a couple things that they were referring to.
Mm-hmm.
Just that kind of stuff. But it was good. It was shot really well. Benedict Cumberbatch is really good.
Is that, was Doctor Strange, was he in the new Spider-Man movie?
Yes. I think he's the one, he lives in, like, a creepy mansion.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure Peter Parker goes to, like, talk to him about something. I probably sound like such a dumbass. He's, like, more in the beginning of the movie, right?
I don't know. Doesn't Spider-Man? I don't even know. I'm going to try to explain it, but it's not going to work, so I'm just going to stop.
I'm pretty sure he is in the new Spider-Man movie.
Yeah. See, I don't follow Marvel, really, so it would be so lost trying to watch any of them.
Yeah, it's a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a lot. The new Thor movie coming out looks pretty good, too, because there was previews for that.
Hmm.
So that'll be something to do, too.
Yeah. I haven't seen a movie. Oh, and I went to a drag show. That was fun.
I know. I'm so jealous.
I know. They put on a good show. It was actually, I had, one of my good friends, actually introduced me to the drag queen that, like, ran it. That was probably, like, 4 years ago, but... So when I got there and I recognized the name, I was like, oh my god, what a small world.
What's the name?
Monique Too Soon.
Monique Too Soon. I like it.
I always like the play on words that they usually have their names. In their names.
Alright, so we're going to be coming at you with some... I have a true crime story, and you have missing person?
Yeah, my usual.
Cool. All right, well, I guess we can get into it.
Tell me a story.
My story is about a girl named Martha Puebla, and the man involved in it is named, that has the weird storyline in it. His name is Juan Catalan. On November 27th, 2002, 16-year-old Martha Puebla was sitting in her room in Sun Valley, California, when there was a knock at her window. So it's like a first floor type of situation.
Okay.
When she looked out, her friend, who in the media has requested not to be identified, was at the window, and her boyfriend, Christian Vargas, was parked on the street outside.
The friend's boyfriend, or...?
The friend's boyfriend.
Okay.
As the girls were talking, a car pulled up to Christian's car, and shots start ringing out. The friend jumps into Martha's window, and both of the girls took cover in there until things quieted down outside.
Oh my god.
I know.
That's real intense real quick.
Right. When they went out to check on Christian, they discovered that he was dead, like, almost immediately. Mm-hmm. And 911 was called. Police initially suspected that, based on the people involved in the area, that members of the gang, the Vineland Boys, were involved. The Vineland Boys is a gang comprised of mostly Hispanic and Mexican-American members that mostly operated in the San Fernando Valley area of California. It was founded in 1988 and right now has about 300 members. And most of their thing is they run drugs for Mexican drug cartel.
Okay.
There. According to police, an early suspect was from the gang was a man by the name of Jose Ledesma. When interviewed, the friend told LAPD detectives that Martha had recognized him as one of the shooters. When police questioned Martha, she explained that she was just kind of, you know, shooting the shit with her friend, like trying to figure, like between them, figure out who could have done this, and came... That was one of the names she threw out there.
Okay.
In fact, she didn't tell law enforcement many details at all about the crime. Being from around the area, Martha knew better than to talk to police, especially when a gang member might be involved.
Right.
Snitches get stitches, I wrote in big caps.
That's the motto.
Yep. So everyone pretty much around there knows to keep their mouth shut. No one's going to say anything. So knowing that, the LAPD knowing that, that no one's really going to say anything, they still got a warrant to search the home of Ledesma's family, where they did find a loaded assault rifle and different documents from other Vineland Boys members.
Are we gonna...
The family member...
Sorry.
It's okay.
Are we gonna... find the motive?
I don't...
Or was it just random?
I don't think it was random. I think it was drug related. And I don't know if I put, I might, I don't remember because I wrote these notes last week. So I think that it is drug related. But there is a
net. Was the boyfriend the target?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. I guess that's boyfriend more was the target. Was my question.
Yeah. He was the main target in that.
Okay.
When the police were searching the home, the family members that were present told officers that Jose had been staying with another gang member, Mario Catalan. The two men had actually fled to Tijuana, Mexico at the time. But 2 days after the home search happened, Mexican police responded to a domestic abuse call from someone who overheard Ledesma and his girlfriend fighting. The girlfriend informed them that both men were wanted for murder in L.A., and soon they were extradited to LAPD's North Hollywood station. So they caught the guys in Mexico, and they're heading back now.
Okay.
During the interrogation, LAPD Detective Matt Pinner told Ledesma that he had witnesses who would testify that Ledesma was responsible for Vargas's murder. To back it up, Pinner showed Ledesma what is known as a six-pack, which is a basically a sheet of paper with six different mugshots on it that are usually shown to, like, victims or witnesses so they can point out, you know, if they recognize anybody. On it, Ledesma's photo was circled with the initials MP from Martha Puebla written next to it. And in the margins of the paper, there was handwritten, "Those is the guy that killed my friend's boyfriend," followed by Martha's signature, quote unquote.
Okay.
When detectives searched the car that the men had driven to Mexico, they found the handgun that would eventually be linked to Vargas's and one other murder that week. After informing Catalan about the weapon's discovery, Pinner then placed him and Ledesma in a holding cell with a hidden microphone in hopes that the two suspects would confess something damning. At this point, Catalan told Ledesma that the authorities had found the gun in the vehicle. That night, after he heard about the gun, Ledesma used a payphone outside his cell and called a friend. The conversation was a mix of Spanish and English. The recording of the call, Pinner said in a sworn testimony, was badly transcribed twice by an outside company used by the LAPD. So at the time, they couldn't really tell what the phone call was about.
Okay.
On May 12th, 2003, Martha was sitting on the curb outside of her home while chatting with a friend. A man walked up behind the pair. "Who are you?" he asked Martha. She said, "I'm Martha. You know me." The man then removed a 9mm handgun from his sweatshirt pocket and began firing. The fatal shot was so close to her face that it left burn marks on the friend's cheek that was sitting next to her.
Whoa.
I know. Pretty intense. Based on sources, detectives suspected that a man by the name of Juan Catalan, who is the brother of Mario, who's in prison right now, was behind the murder of Martha. He was arrested and jailed, yet he claimed he was innocent and had been at a Dodgers game with his six-year-old daughter at the time of the killing. But police told Catalan that they had a witness who put him at the scene. So, for his defense, he hired a lawyer named Todd Melnick, who typically didn't do this kind of case. He was just kind of what Catalan could afford at the time. Catalan showed him, he produced ticket stubs to his lawyer, but his lawyer, Todd Melnick, knew that he would have to prove that not only that someone had bought the tickets, but that it was definitely him and that he actually was at the game that day. He the lawyer then watched a television recording of the game, but he couldn't find, it was so panned out that he couldn't find Juan on the tapes.
So
now,
he didn't shoot the friend that was with Martha, right?
Mm-mm.
So she's a witness.
Yes, it was just Martha, but the friend did not get a good look at the guy.
Okay.
She got a look at him, but the description that she gave was a Hispanic male, short cropped hair, dressed in black. So it was very, for the area that they were in,
yeah,
very generic description.
Okay.
And they're going by, they know that it's someone that specifically went after Martha because the police provided that fake, like, witness statement from her,
mm-hmm.
you know? So by the police doing that, they put this 16-year-old girl in danger.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah.
Well, she wouldn't have died. She didn't say anything. You know? She didn't give them anything. They wrote it on I'm giving away the end, but they wrote it on the paper that, you know, I saw this, and it wasn't anything that she put on there, because they're allowed to do that in interrogations, I guess.
Wow.
Lie.
Hmm.
I know. So the lawyer is telling Catalan, listen, you got to give me something else. Is there any way, any receipt, anything to prove that you were at this game? Catalan remembers one little thing about this game. Someone in his section said that someone by the name of Super Dave Osborne, who is actor and comedian Bob Einstein, who plays Marty Funkhauser on Curb Your Enthusiasm, was in attendance. Have you ever seen that show?
No.
On HBO? It's pretty funny. Have you ever seen Seinfeld?
Yeah, but not for a long time.
It's the creator of Seinfeld. He stars in Curb Your Enthusiasm. It's like loosely based on situations that come up in his life,
mm-hmm.
sort of thing. So this caused the attorney Melnick to reach out to Dodgers media relations department, which oversees filming the stadium. A phone number was listed for who was taping at the park that day. Melnick called it, and the person picked up the phone and said, HBO, how can we help you? So he had no idea that he would be reaching like a major television network like that.
Mm-hmm.
He asked if he could view their stadium footage for the show, which had not yet aired. The television network at first told him no, because they typically don't leak footage that hasn't aired yet. But when creator Larry David heard that it would be using to kind of set someone free, he quickly sent him over the tapes. Melnick reviewed footage over 3 hours of film that was there, and he said, towards the end, lo and behold, there's my client and his daughter and two friends. He said, I almost jumped out of my chair. So this is how crazy it is, because there's a Netflix documentary about this too,
mm-hmm.
and it just so happened that Juan and his daughter had gotten up to go get something from the refreshment stand. When they were coming back, he got stopped by camera crews saying, we just are filming this one scene, can you just wait for a second and we'll get you back to your seats in a sec. So they just happened to be filming a scene on the aisle that he was sitting in, and as Larry David's going down the aisle and they're taping him, you can see Juan and his daughter at the top of the stairs and start coming down behind him to find their seat. So it's a clear picture of he and his daughter, time stamped at 9 o'clock at night. And it proves that he was there.
Wow.
It was about an hour before the shooting occurred. So this, paired with cell phone records, showed that Catalan was still in the vicinity of Dodger Stadium at the time of the killing, and it caused the judge to dismiss the case when presented with evidence. So he had already been facing life in prison. And it just, this one technical thing happened. If that HBO show wasn't being brought, like, taped that day, at that time, in his section, like, he wouldn't have gotten out, which is nuts.
That's crazy.
Yeah, and I think on the documentary, he says that he wasn't even supposed to go that day. His boss had given him the tickets and was like, hey, I can't make it tonight. Do you want to take your daughter?
Wow.
So he wasn't even supposed to be there. However, Catalan had already spent 5 months in jail after being arrested in front of his young daughter after a police misconduct suit against the city. So the Los Angeles City Council agreed to pay $320,000 to settle. Can you guess how much he saw of that?
None of it.
He saw $1,500 to date.
Oh my God.
From that. I know. Oh man. And like I said before, story doesn't end there. The truth is that the six pack that had Puebla's signature, which police presented to Ledesma while they were interrogating him over the killing of Christian Vargas, was fake. Law enforcement officers had falsified Puebla's information. Juan Rodriguez, the partner of LAPD homicide detective Martin Pinner, had circled Ledesma's photo and forged her statement and signature, which is legal. Legal, but controversial.
Huh.
For obvious reasons, because it got a girl killed. Even worse, we must return to the phone call that Ledesma made while incarcerated, which is perhaps the most troubling part of this case. Cokester, Ledesma said during his call, talking about his friend Javier Covarrubias by a gang moniker. Do you know the slut that lives there by my house? Her name starts with an M. I need her to disappear. She's dropping dimes, but keep a low profile. Stay on your toes, homie, and don't get caught.
Oh my God.
Yeah, and then parentheses, I put, dropping dimes means revealing information.
Thanks for clearing that one up.
Yeah. Pinner said in a sworn testimony that the phone call's contents remained unknown until January 2005, so that's 2 years after her murder occurred, when during preparation for Ledesma's trial for Vargas's slaying, when Spanish-speaking officers finally listened to the conversation. So they know that the conversation contains Spanish, didn't bother to have a Spanish-speaking officer listen to it.
Oh my God.
For years.
And this is all the LAPD, right?
Yes. Yep.
Notorious.
LAPD, for sucking. Late 90s, early 2000s, right. Had they understood what was on the call sooner, not only would detectives have known about the plot and possibly could have foiled it, they also could have identified who was actually behind the crime and wouldn't have cost taxpayers hundreds of thousands and left a scar on a man's life that will last forever. Referring to Juan. In 2008, Vineland Boys gang member Raul Robledo was sentenced to life in connection with the murder. Ledesma and Covarrubias admitted their roles in Puebla's death and are serving life sentences. Puebla's parents understandably filed a lawsuit against the city. A federal jury did find that the two detectives were negligent over the photo ruse. However, jurors found that Puebla and her parents were 80% responsible for her death and the detectives were 20% at fault. And the family was awarded $1
My God.
For the LAPD's negligence.
A in the dollar?
Case. A dollar.
Oh.
Yep.
My God.
And I believe it was, they were found 80% responsible for her death because they were letting a 16-year-old girl hang out on her curb with her friend outside of their house at night in a dangerous neighborhood.
Oh my God. So. I know, I was gonna comment on, like, how exactly do you figure out that percentage? Like, what?
Who the fuck knows?
Right.
And, you know, it's probably controversial or whatever, but it's because it's probably a minority household mm-hmm. that lives in a gang area. It's like, I feel bad because a lot of, they probably didn't have a ton of money to fight it either.
Right.
So it's just kind of, in this case too, Martha's mom didn't speak a lot of Spanish. So for a lot of the court proceedings, she didn't know what was going on. They eventually got a translator to come in and explain to her, you know, what's happening, but it makes it hard to defend yourself too.
Yeah, no, for sure.
And so yeah, that is the case of Martha Puebla.
Wow, that was a good one. I've never heard of that one.
Mm-hmm.
That's wild.
It's another of my favorite Netflix. It's called Long Shot, the Netflix movie.
They have
made in 2017.
Netflix has a lot of different stories.
Oh yeah, I love Netflix.
I know. I need to dive into some of those because I never think to.
All right. So what do you have for us today?
All right. So I did these notes a while ago, so it's going to be a bit of a refresher on my end as well, because I probably did this. I started this before I did the Brittany Drexel one, so I did these over a month ago.
Yeah.
But that's okay. So I have the disappearance of Jeremy Alex.
Jeremy Alex.
Yes. Okay, so Jeremy disappeared Saturday, April 24th, 2004. He was 28 when he disappeared. He lived in Belfast, Maine, which is a little bit south of Bangor, Maine, right on the coast. So, like,
okay,
the middle of Maine, but all the way at the bottom of it. He was known to his friends and family as a free spirit. He was known for his love of music. One of his favorite bands was The Grateful Dead. When he was around 17 or 18, he went cross-country in a van following that band around.
Oh, jeez.
So, Belfast was known as an area where a lot of hippies moved to. It was a very minimal-type living area. He loved the ocean, mm-hmm. the forest, the mountains. He seemed to be a very hands-on, woodsy type guy.
That's cool.
So Jeremy had a father and stepmother named Ted and Susan Alex, and they lived in New Hampshire, in Portsmouth, New Hampshire.
Okay.
He spent a lot of summers with them, but he mainly lived with his mom in Belfast.
Okay. Did he live in a van, or that was just when he was traveling?
I think that was just when he was traveling.
Okay.
Okay, so, yeah, so Portsmouth, where his dad and stepmom live, is about a 2.5-hour drive south of Belfast, Maine, where he lived with his mom most of the time. So, In the spring of 2004 is when his family and friends began growing really concerned about him. His normal, cheerful, and happy-go-lucky personality had changed. He began throwing out false accusations and was becoming increasingly paranoid. He continued to be paranoid and lose his trust in people, which only negatively affected his friends and family, of course. So he became a lot more distant.
How old was he? 28?
28, yes. His parents were planning on coming up to Maine to visit Jeremy on this day for a belated birthday celebration. So I believe the day I'm talking about is
April.
Yes. 24th? Yes, I think so.
Okay. Okay.
So they had called him and left him a message saying they wanted to come up to visit and take him out because it had been his birthday. So Jeremy had some issues growing up, and he was known to be rebellious. His father and stepmother did say, however, that he made a lot of positive changes in his life. His parents divorced when he was a kid, and I think that had a big impact on him, and he struggled with that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So Sunday, April 25th, Jeremy's dad turned his cell phone on, and there was a message from Jeremy left on his phone. This message was from Jeremy's phone, but it was not from Jeremy. It was from the Belfast police. They had, so the police had found his cell phone, keys, and van, and were searching for him. So Jeremy was supposed to be moving into a new house in Northport, Maine, which is just outside of Belfast, with his girlfriend at the time, Suzanne. And I've actually been to Northport, Maine, which is was kind of cool that, not cool, because cool is not the best word, but I've been to the area they're talking about, which is interesting.
Yeah, that sounds familiar, Northport.
Yeah, because I think I always wanted to call it there too. North Point. And that's wrong.
Wrong.
Okay. So they had, Jeremy and Suzanne had been together for more than 3 years. According to everyone that knew them, they were great friends and had a really good relationship. At the beginning of their relationship, Suzanne states that he wasn't smoking cigarettes, drinking, or, you know, doing any drugs. But that changed when they got to Belfast. So this area is known for having a problem with drugs. He started using, but not all the time. Suzanne said he'd go on, like, a weekend binge every 6 months or so. She kind of just said whatever to it. She didn't want to see it, so, like, go, take off, have your weekend. I don't want to see it. But, of course, you know, it just became more frequent.
Right. Exactly.
So Jeremy's stepmother called Suzanne right away around 7 a.m. and filled her in on what was going on, meaning the they had got the voicemail from the police saying they were looking for Jeremy and found his things. But they really didn't get any more information from the police other than they had found, you know, his keys, van, whatever, and that he was missing.
Mm-hmm.
But Suzanne knew something that his parents didn't. So Thursday, April 22nd, okay, so this is a couple days before Jeremy went missing.
Yes.
So this was the last happy day that Jeremy and Suzanne spent together. They went snowboarding at Sugarloaf Mountain, which is about a two-hour drive, 95 miles, or 152 kilometers northwest of the town of Belfast, still in Maine.
Yep. That I have been to.
Have you?
Sugarloaf. Yeah, it's wicked pretty out there.
I bet. So Suzanne claimed that they actually had a really fun day that day. But when they got home that day, Jeremy seemed eager to part ways. He claimed he needed to move some things into their new home. Suzanne was suspicious, of course, that he was going to go on a binge. The next time she sees Jeremy after this is Saturday morning.
Ugh. And they're still living together. Right? Like, they're moving stuff from one home they share to another home they share?
I don't know. I don't think they live together already. They do. I don't know. I'm not sure, honestly.
Because one, I mean, in both cases it's weird, but one makes it a lot weirder than the other one. Because it's like, where have you been for a couple days?
Yeah.
You know? I couldn't live like that. Like, more power to her for just being like, okay, get it out of your system for a couple days.
I know.
If you're still alive, I'll see you next weekend, you know?
Right.
So, obviously, it didn't work out very well, but...
Yeah, right, clearly.
Yeah.
So, Friday, April 23rd, 2004, a friend of Jeremy's said she spent this night with him the night before he disappeared, doing drugs at his new house in Northport. They were doing cocaine and heroin. She said that when she left in the morning, she expressed concern that Jeremy should stop. So Saturday, April 24th, 2004. So Suzanne last saw Jeremy 3 days earlier from than the call from Jeremy's parents.
Right.
So only if there had been 3 days in between when she had last seen Jeremy and him, well, missing, I guess, and them realizing he's missing. So apparently when she had seen him, he wasn't in his right mind. This is a good example of his angry and accusatory behavior. He was disorientated and freaking out, saying some bad guys are after him. He kept phrasing it, "The bad guys are after me." He also said to Suzanne, "You and two other mutual friends of ours were outside my house last night with ski masks." Suzanne, of course, had no idea what he was talking about.
I mean, it sounds like he's, it sounds like he's a schizophrenic.
Yes. Don't you think? Yes, clearly something's wrong. Because that's around the time where it comes up.
Yeah. I think in males, like, their early to mid-20s is when you start seeing some real symptoms of it.
Yeah, well, between that and fucking...
And then all the drugs.
Yeah, exactly. Heroin, it'll make you...
Yeah.
I got told by somebody close to me who's been around people who have done drugs that, specifically this was, I think, meth, but it, like, specifically makes you think that, like, people are after you and, like, you know, like, like, peeking out windows and, like, you're so convinced and so paranoid that, like, somebody's after you. So it's, like, maybe, it's hard to tell with this, like, maybe... Because he was involved in drugs, like, maybe somebody was after him.
Maybe that's...
Or he was just, you know, delirious, and who knows?
Who knows? I mean, have you ever smoked too much, like, weed and get a little paranoid? I can't imagine doing, like, heroin.
Yeah, no.
or anything like that that kind of alters your brain... that much.
Yeah, I can't. No, because I can't even, if I take, like, a new medicine and I'm, like, paranoid that, like, something crazy is gonna happen.
Same.
Too much anxiety for that, so.
Right, exactly.
Good news, I won't do drugs.
Side note, and this has nothing to do with your case, I'm sorry, but I just wanted to put it out there. I had started a new medication recently. I started... One of the side effects, I guess, at first is that you can get hot flashes.
Oh, great.
And the first day that it happened, I got so panicked that something actually was happening. And it was at work. And
oh, my God.
One of our owners there talked me down. And she was like, "You just started medication, right?" And I was like, "Oh, yeah." So I had, like, beads of sweat just dripping down my face.
I wasn't there, and was nothing, I?
I don't remember. I don't think so. I feel like I would have happened noticed. Again the next day. And I think you were there the next day. And we were talking about it. But, yeah, it's crazy how just, like, simple things like that can be like, oh, God, I'm dying.
Yep, yep. That's exactly how my brain works. So you're not alone.
And that's a totally sober brain. Exactly. So I can't imagine. Yeah. Good point with that. Anyway, back to Jeremy.
All right. Yeah, so after he was saying that, like, Suzanne and two other friends of theirs were standing outside his house in ski masks, like, you know, Suzanne obviously had no idea what he was talking about. She then says that's when she realized he was using cocaine because he wasn't in the right state of mind. She, of course, was upset and crying at what was going on. And then abruptly, Jeremy's attitude changed and he attempted to comfort her. So a little bit after that, when things cool down, Jeremy continues to load some stuff into his van for the new house, but won't tell Suzanne what's wrong. At that point, Suzanne is just kind of fed up again, and is just like, whatever, I'll talk to him in a couple days when he sleeps this off or whatever. Right. So that's the incident that Jeremy's parents were not aware of, that when I said earlier that, Suzanne knew something they didn't. So they were not aware of that, like, episode.
Did they know that he was using any type of hard drugs at all?
I do not know. I think... I don't know. I don't know the answer. I want to say they maybe had an idea, but I don't know that for sure. So around 5:20 p.m. on this Saturday in Northport, so a few hours after Suzanne had last seen Jeremy... A husband and wife that live in Northport are startled when a man comes out of the woods and into their yard, this man being Jeremy. The woman happens to recognize Jeremy from when he was a student at Belfast High School, where she worked at one time. He was agitated and had cash in his hands. The husband went out there to confront Jeremy. According to the husband, he was very distraught and hallucinating and very frightened. Here again is when he was saying that people were threatening and trying to hurt him. The couple was going to call 911, but that only made things worse, and Jeremy began to panic even more, and he just took off running.
Oh, no.
After that, no one else seems to hear from Jeremy.
Like, ever? That was the last contact anybody had with him?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That doesn't sound good.
I know. Okay, so all of this now, it's not easy to do this when you have not done the notes recently.
I know it's not.
Okay. All right, so this is all after the phone call from Jeremy's parents. So this is after he's missing. This is after they're aware that he's missing. So Jeremy had been staying in their new home in Northport, getting the home ready for the two of them to move into. So after the phone call Suzanne got from Jeremy's parents, she went to this house in Northport. It had seemed like Jeremy had made it back to that house after their strange encounter on that Saturday morning. And Jeremy's parents didn't make it up to this area until Monday, April 26th in the afternoon. So they didn't make it up there to, like, help look or anything for, like, 2 days after. Or until 2 days after. Suzanne reported that when she arrived at the house, the door was open and the keys were in the lock. There was no sign of Jeremy. When Suzanne finally made it to Belfast to talk to police, they let her know that no one had seen him since Saturday afternoon. After she was made aware of Jeremy's disappearance, she cleaned up at their house in Northport, which included throwing away any drugs, which was heroin and cocaine, that were there. She was trying to hide the fact that Jeremy was using because she didn't want him to get in trouble if he was found.
So she cleaned up the scene of where he potentially last was.
Right.
Okay,
and I can answer your question because I have Jeremy's parents did not know he was using those types of drugs.
Oh, okay.
So I was wrong.
All right.
But I think, like,
so
when he was younger, he kind of got into, like, a bad crowd. So I think, like, they knew he had the potential to, like, fall into that type of stuff. But apparently they did not know to this extent.
Yeah, they didn't know he was going on benders every few weeks and
right
disappearing.
So eventually Suzanne does tell the police about the drug use and that she got rid of what she could. On Sunday, April...
Bleh.
Oh my God, sorry. On Sunday, April 25th...
I was just spit out my beer. That was a good one.
Oh God.
Sorry.
No. Okay. On Sunday, April 25th, the day after Jeremy went missing... The police investigate Jeremy's van, which was parked in a secluded area in Northport. They found his cell phone, registration, and keys. That is when they call Jeremy's father from Jeremy's phone. At the start of all this, the police believed that Jeremy was lost in the woods somewhere. Because that area up there is
right. Insane.
And it's so much woods, and it's just endless. Like, it would be so easy to get lost in the woods out there.
Right. Yeah.
It appeared as if Jeremy left the van and would be right back. Friends and family were up there looking through the rough terrain of the woods in Maine. The woods up there are harsh and cold, so if Jeremy was, you know, or is out there lost in the woods, he wouldn't be able to last too many nights.
Mm-hmm.
They brought dogs out to search the area, too, but there were no signs of Jeremy. So now Suzanne and Jeremy's parents are told about the strange encounter where Jeremy was in that husband and wife's backyard. So now they're finding out about, like, the last sighting of him. And Suzanne had encountered Jeremy in that type of state that same day and thought it was due to drug use, but now she can't help but wonder... Because he was so persistent that maybe somebody was after him. And, like, even having the money in his hand, like, I don't know. It's hard to tell.
Right.
Okay, so now that some of the information is being released to the public, a motorist reports that she saw a man resembling Jeremy crossing the road on foot in front of her on Route 1. And when she looked back in her rearview mirror after she passed him, he crossed back over... the street again, to the original side of the street.
Hmm.
You know, most people that were seeing this going on just thought, you know, the police was looking for somebody lost in the woods. So again, the day after Jeremy went missing, there was another tip of somebody seeing Jeremy. This person who... Okay, so this person claimed she saw Jeremy supposedly talking to two men in a pickup truck. They were hoping that that truck would potentially lead to something. I guess that area is known for drug use, so like maybe he was, you know, getting drugs from that truck. Right. If it was him. Wednesday, April 28th, Jeremy's stepmother began to press his friends and acquaintances for information they might know, but no one said anything at this point. When the police began to look into the drug connection to this case, Jeremy's friends became a lot more quiet than they already were being, because they didn't want to be get in trouble for the drug, you know, for using drugs.
Right.
But yeah. In the end, that wasn't helping find their missing friend. So Jeremy's dad took charge in the search and did everything he could to find his son, including getting a helicopter to search the area. May 2nd, 2004, 8 days after Jeremy first went missing, a second official search begins. At this point, Jeremy would have been out there in the woods surviving for 8 days. His family and friends did believe that he was capable of doing so. Again, he was a very, like, camper-type person, you know, hippie person. That's right. Like, he would, you know, he could do it.
Mm-hmm.
And his dad did say there was a possibility that Jeremy did just take off. So in September of 2004, 5 months after Jeremy disappeared, there's a final search over the terrain, but that also leads to nothing. Now his parents are beginning to think foul play was involved. His parents did end up putting a reward for $20,000 up and tried to keep Jeremy's case in the media as much as possible. 6 months after his disappearance, there was a tip that a man resembling Jeremy appeared out of the woods in another part of Maine. This person appeared shaken up and didn't speak at all. Wayne Drinkwater, the owner of a sandwich shop in Belfast, was one of the people to see who they thought was Jeremy in this type of situation. He pressed the guy for his name, but he didn't respond and just kind of walked off unresponsive. Wayne then contacted police saying he believed that he found Jeremy. When the whole thing was pursued, it was just another dead end. This person turned out to be someone that did look a lot like Jeremy, but with someone who was suffering from mental health issues, this lookalike also happened to be named Jeremy.
Huh. That's a coincidence.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of weird.
Yeah, that's weird.
So August 25th, 2006, more than 2 years later, the state police search a pond called Knight's Pond in Northport. There had been a tip from someone who had been arrested that their boyfriend killed Jeremy and threw him in this pond. They didn't find anything. August 2008, Jeremy's dad received an email from Jim Baker saying that he had Jeremy's license and his money. He didn't follow the case closely and apparently didn't know much about it. Jim Baker says this is how he ended up with Jeremy's stuff. On a night in April 2004, a friend came up to Jim saying, I don't know why I'm having such a hard time with this.
It's okay.
Jeremy... Oh my god. See, that's what I'm doing. Jeremy and Jim. You know what? I went to school with a kid named Jeremy Baker. That's what's fucking me up.
Oh. Gotcha.
Okay. So Jim Baker says this is how he ended up with Jeremy's stuff. On a night in April 2004, a friend came up to Jim saying how he had hit the jackpot because money had begun washing up on his beach. Anything they collect on the beach, they apparently keep.
Right, finders keepers.
Right. So April 2008, almost 4 years to the day Jeremy disappeared, Jim's friend Tim, who found the money, was killed in a freak accident on his oceanfront property. A few months later, Tim's wife invites Jim over, and she begins to retell the story of how they found the money on the beach. They still had it saved even 4 years later.
Huh.
I know.
That's weird.
I know. She then mentioned it was with the driver's license that they had also found with the money. Jim asked them if they had ever contacted anyone about it, and she said no. This ID was Jeremy's ID.
That's not good.
Yeah, so that's when Jim connected the dots that this was the guy who went missing a few years prior. Jim contacted police, but no one was returning his call, which is what made him email Jeremy's dad directly. So Jeremy's dad was very discouraged because they had been searching this area. They had put up posters all in this area, and this couple just never realized this was the property of somebody missing. Maybe had they realized it just days after Jeremy went missing, something could have, you know, come of it.
Wait a sec. So they found this money in this ID washed up just a few days after he went missing?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because
that's so weird.
It doesn't say a specific day, but it says April 2004, and he disappeared in April 2004.
Yeah, huh.
Yeah, so it was pretty... Exactly, like, for 4 years with all of that going on in the area, like, you wouldn't... I don't know, if I found somebody's ID just washed up, I probably would at least Google their name.
Yeah, well, so that makes me think differently about it. So if they found it a couple days after he went missing, that more makes me think that... he dropped it as opposed to he drowned, you know, because I feel like you would find it much later if he's out in the lake somewhere dead.
Well, this was the ocean.
Oh, sorry. Scratch all that, I guess. For some reason, they had a lake in my mind.
They did. They searched like, a lake, but this was a beachfront, so this was the ocean. So I'm sure that's the waves just dragging stuff.
Right. Okay, that makes more sense then.
So now the search is more targeted towards the water rather than the woods. I don't know. I think I kept fucking up the names because now I'm saying Ted himself went back to the area where the money and ID were found and searched everywhere for any sign of anything. But Ted's dead, so I don't think... That's not right.
Who's Ted?
Ted's the husband of the...
Oh, I thought that was...
See?
Tim.
Who the fuck's Ted? Oh, Ted is Jeremy's dad.
Okay. God.
I thought, see? Jim, Tim, Ted.
Yeah, because Jim and Tim.
Okay, so there we go. You cleared it up for me. Ted, Jeremy's dad, went back to that area where the money and ID were found and searched everywhere for any sign of anything. That makes more sense. Getting through it.
Getting through there.
Oh, I just made everything gigantic. Where'd my notes go? Okay.
There's something comforting about you having technical difficulties and not me this time.
yeah, it's about time because it's usually you, so.
Right. The cat'll jump up here in a couple minutes, I'm sure.
Seriously. Like, hit the power button, everything goes out.
Yeah.
Okay, so September 2010, there hasn't been any movement in the case. The police won't share details, but everyone seems to think something bad happened to Jeremy. His family still has a missing persons flyer up, and when it gets faded from the sun, they print out a new one and put it up. They're still very hopeful that someone will come forward with information, especially since so much time has passed, so, like, they're thinking maybe, like, the friends who were worried about being in trouble would, you know, step forward and say something by now, because it's been so long.
Mm-hmm.
His parents' final say is that they think foul play is involved, and they do think that somebody is after him. Jim thinks that maybe he fell from the cliffs and got carried out into the ocean. They don't believe, even if they thought Jeremy would, you know, his dad said at one point, like, he could have just taken off. He wouldn't have taken off for this long. So they don't believe that
right. It
was his doing. And he was always known to call on, like, birthdays and holidays at the least, so.
Yeah. Because, I mean, if you only have a limited, well, all his cash is in the ocean anyway, so eventually he's going to come out of that haze, I'm yes. sure, get his wits about him and everything. So the fact that he's gone for that long, I mean, something is going to have happened.
Yeah. Jeremy's dad developed the Jeremy Alex Fund to help other people or kids who are at risk and have them not end up like Jeremy. Chess was Jeremy's favorite game, so this organization gives out chess boards to all the fourth graders in town, along with directions on how to play.
Aw, that's cute.
I know. Ted goes in and speaks to the kids on decision-making as well, and makes it known that every action has a consequence, and he hopes that these kids will make better decisions hearing Jeremy's story.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So Jeremy's a white male with brown hair and brown eyes. He's 5'5" to 5'7" tall and weighs 150 pounds. He was last seen wearing an olive green flannel Timberland sweatshirt, a pair of blue jeans, or brown corduroy pants and sneakers. He was also carrying a red backpack. And if you have any information regarding Jeremy's disappearance, please contact the Maine State Police at 207-624-7076. And that is the disappearance of Jeremy Alex.
Oh, wow. Poor guy.
I know.
So, I'm just doing math now. So, if he was alive today, he'd be 46.
Wow.
But I guess we're not thinking. It doesn't sound like he's around.
No.
If I had to guess.
No, don't think so either. I don't know what I think, though. Like,
I know. Do you think that someone was actually after him?
I don't know. Because it's like, I want to say that maybe, either way, I believe his body is in the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not he did fall in, or somebody, you know, took him, killed him, dumped him in the ocean, or even took him, killed him, and dumped his stuff in the ocean. Like, who knows?
Yeah. Or maybe he thought that someone was chasing him and drugged up thought, I know, I'll jump into the ocean and swim away from them,
mm-hmm.
and didn't think it through and, you know, unfortunately passed away.
Yeah.
Like, maybe something weird like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It seems crazy that it's a little unbelievable to me that someone was actually following him around. But you never know.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. It's hard to tell because I don't know. You would think somebody maybe would have known about something like that, or like, you know, ooh, I know I saw him dealing with these sketchy people or whatever. Like, you'd think.
Yeah.
Somebody would have some type of idea.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. Always leave you thinking.
Yeah. I feel bad for his parents.
Yeah, I know. It was really nice to see that his dad was, you know, doing something to help other kids and to keep Jeremy's story being told.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if they still put up the, you know, when the missing poster fades from the sun, I wonder if they still put it up. It's like, that's sad to just, like, I don't know, just thinking about that, like, when you just keep walking by it, it's faded enough, you put up a new one, you just, in the just years and years of that, like.
Yeah.
Ugh.
There's a, on a highway going into New Hampshire, I want to say it's when, like, 495 turns into 95, and there is a little stretch where there's always a little setup for, I'm guessing it's a young child that passed away on the side of the road, and every holiday, it's like the saddest thing you ever drive by, because someone goes out there and decorates all the time.
Mm-hmm.
All the time. Christmas, you know, Halloween, things like, there's always like a little tree with decorations and cross and all the stuff, teddy bears, things like that. It always looks new. I always feel so bad because some parent is just going out there all the time, mm-hmm. missing their kid. And
yeah, I know. I hate driving by the, you know, where you just, you know, where accidents have happened and stuff. And there's, you know, like you said, it's the same thing. People just, there's always stuff there. There's always new flowers, new, you know.
Yeah.
But.
Right. Yeah. No matter how old your kid is, I'm sure it's so hard to move on from them passing away, especially if they just disappear without a trace. You know, it's going to be so hard to move on from that.
Amanda just sent me a screenshot of, no, Brittany Drexel was last seen April 2009 when she was walking between hotels in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. And it says, a teen vanished on a spring break trip in 2009. Her body was just found and a man has been.
Oh, she just sent me that too.
Could you fucking...
Holy shit.
Matt, this is happening live.
I know.
What?
I'm going to look up right now. Brittany Drexel.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. Found in South Carolina. Suspect is charged. Oh, who is it? Hold on. 62-year-old Raymond Moody charged with murder.
Oh my god.
Oh wow, he looks intense. He has been identified as a possible person of interest in the investigation way back in 2012. They said that her remains were identified through dental records.
Wow. I literally just said that, like, it would be cool to update one, and it literally, like, the next...
Right. That's crazy. I can't wait to hear, like, he's a registered sex offender who spent 21 years in prison following a 1983 abduction and rape case in California involving a 9-year-old girl. His previous bond has been revoked, and now he's being held with no bail. That's crazy. It's going to be crazy to hear how he is involved in that.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
That's crazy.
Wow.
Not to take away from Jeremy.
Right, right. But, like, not what timing. Wow.
Wow. I know.
Wow. Well,
is she the one with the mom named Dawn?
Yes.
Who moved down to South Carolina? Oh, I'm so happy that she at least gets some sort of...
Exactly, yes. Right. And I'm sure she at this point knew that, you know, her daughter was not going to come home alive, but to at least see somebody charged and know what happened.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow, 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 wow. That is one I did not think... we were gonna...
Right.
It's like... Oh my god, the thunder is going crazy right now.
Oh, is that what that
is? Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah, it says they believe his crimes took place April 25th, 2009, and she was buried the next day. Wow.
So they found her buried?
Yeah, I guess so.
Hmm. I know, I'm sure a lot more will come out, and I'm sure other podcasts that have touched on it will, like, I wouldn't be surprised if more morbid research is this and, like, you know, gives an update.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, her cute little face.
Okay, why is somebody who is a registered sex offender who spent 21 years in prison following a 1983 abduction and rape case in California involving a 9-year-old girl. Why is somebody that raped a 9-year-old fucking girl still walking? Are you kidding me?
Yeah. Because they care more about people carrying around weed than actual sex offenders.
It's insane.
I could go on for a long time about that.
Right, I know. But that's just, like, when they always, you know, they always... People get out and they just fucking do it again. Like, if you're that scum, like, you're nothing's gonna stop you from doing more stuff like that, so...
Yeah, that's one of those things that I think when you are... When there's no reform for pedophiles.
No, in my opinion. No.
Yeah, and it's just one of those things where it's like... I don't know, I'm trying to be kind of nice about it, but there is no nice thing. Like, it's not going to stop.
No, it's not.
No. Like, that poor girl, what's her name? J.C. Duggard. Like, that guy was, you know, he was convicted of some child stuff before that. It's just, like, they just get better at hiding it.
Mm-hmm. Damn. Well. What a way to end the episode.
I know. We don't need to think of pointless banter.
Right, I know, yeah.
I'm just going to Google a bunch of stuff about that now.
All right, you can tell me about it even tomorrow, because I don't want to Google
if
it.
If he was just, I know, if he just got arrested today, though, I'm sure nothing big's going to come out of it until he goes to trial.
Wow, that is like, that's crazy. That gives me a weird feeling. Like, it's almost like, I don't know.
I wonder how they, like, knew to look for her.
Well, it's, yeah, I want to know, like, how they know where she was, how they, like, right.
Yeah, if it was buried.
Yeah, exactly. There has to be something to the story, and I'm sure more will come out, but damn.
Yeah, amazing. Well, I'm glad it finally came to a halt. I'm guessing she was just, I'm trying to remember what you said. She was brought out to, like, almost like the boonies, right? Where there's known crack houses and things like that. Yeah, it
was like 50 miles away from where she was in Myrtle Beach.
Yeah. So we could probably connect the dots, what her last moments were like.
Yeah, exactly. And And clearly that guy is, you know, a rapist and a terrible fucking person, so.
Mm-hmm. And she looks younger than 17, too, so.
Yeah.
He probably thought that she was younger, too. Oh, man.
Damn.
Well, good.
Wild.
Now you have a little solving for one of your cold cases.
Right. Wow. I know. I didn't think it was going to happen that soon that they'd find.
Right, exactly.
Find something.
You could take a little bit of credit for it.
Right. Didn't I? I think it's maybe morbid that, like, when they touch on something, like, it's usually, like, new news will break, like, fairly soon. So, like, maybe that's what'll happen right with ours.
I know. Maybe.
Probably not. But whatever. But that was a big case, and that was.
Yeah. That's definitely a big case.
Fucking wild. Damn. Well.
Well, on that note.
Right.
Again, if you'd like to send us your stories, you can reach us on whathaveyoudonepod@gmail.com. If you want to talk Brittany Drexel and all that. Or some of your stories would be preferred.
I know. We haven't even gotten one story, guys. Come on now.
Not one.
I have so many people that are like, I have a good story for your podcast, and they just don't do anything. And I'm like, okay.
Right. Like, just come talk to us.
Right. We're cool. I promise.
Yeah. Follow us on Instagram, too, at whatHaveYouDonePod. Slide into our DMs.
Slide on in.
Yeah. Brooke is single, so if you want to contact her that way, you can as well. Just to get someone talking to us.
Just throw me right out there, it's fine. Oh god.
And all right, well, I guess if that's it, we can sign off here.
Yep, I think we're good. Wow, what a way to end it.
I know.
All right, well,
see you next time.
Bye
bye.